From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today we're talking about species that thrive and some that don't. First up, lobster. There are different kinds of lobster. You know this, right? You've seen Blue Planet. There are those colorful, tropical, spiny lobsters that don't have claws. There are scampi, which are actually technically tiny lobsters. There are slipper lobsters that look like a shoe. There are furry lobsters that look furry. The red ones that you find at the grocery store or in traps off the coast of Maine, they're American lobsters. But there's also a European lobster, and they look almost identical. They're maybe a little smaller, have thicker shells, and are a slightly different color. And when you're a lobster expert, people bring you all sorts of weird-looking lobsters, and it's just a normal part of the job.
It's usually just leisure fishermen or commercial fishermen that say, oh, this is a funny-looking lobster, odd-looking lobster, what can this be?
So a fisherman would just come into the office at the university and say, yeah. Hey, I found this, yeah. What is it?
Yeah, basically. This is funny, what do you think? Yeah, this was a funny one.
This is Anne-Lisbeth Agnalt, a scientist at the Norwegian Institute for Marine Research. Usually, up in Norway, fishers are bringing her really purple lobsters, which is a color that large female European lobsters take on when they've been living very far offshore. And usually she'd just reassure them.
Oh, no, this is okay. This is a purple one. They do. Have you been fishing a little bit on, you know, outskirts area now? Yeah. I've been there.
But in 1999, she got something different. European lobsters are typically a certain color.
Black in coloration, but they also come in like blue and also in purple, some of them.
But this lobster
would be more reddish, greenish.
Immediately, Anne-Lisbeth was like,
Sometimes you do get some odd-looking ones, but not that odd.
Alarm bells are going off in her head. But to verify what they had found, took a DNA test.
DNA is really, that's 100% method.
When the test came back, it confirmed what she had suspected. This was an American lobster. It was the American part of the name that was immediately the concern. A lot of times you'll hear place names prefixed onto species names that are invasive. The European green crab, Dutch elm disease, Japanese knotweed. This tells you that at least these species are out of place. It's non-native. So when a fisherman dropped this American lobster off at the lab, Anne-Lisbeth was immediately thinking, might these lobsters actually be something worse? Might they outcompete, outperform, and outsurvive their dark-shelled European cousins? Maybe American lobsters would even breed with the Europeans, but the offspring would be sterile, like mules. This would mean that even though they were breeding, the population would decline. At first, she and the other Scandinavian scientists were worried, but not necessarily freaked out. One rogue lobster didn't really prove much of anything. But over the years, a few more American lobsters started turning up. It took a decade to get the full freak-out stage.
We looked at her and we said, oh no, this is American lobster. And then I looked at the eggs and I said, uh-oh. And then my colleague was actually, I don't want to hear anything of your uh-oh. So she went straight to the lab and ran the analysis. And she came back and said, I definitely didn't like your uh-oh.
What Anne-Lisbeth had been handed was something she was afraid of, but thought it was really unlikely she would ever be lucky enough to find. A female American lobster with eggs that had been fertilized by a European lobster. She had found a clutch of hybrids. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. And today, we have a question. American lobsters are living in Scandinavian waters, luring away male European lobsters and making babies. This is a fact, but how to respond to that fact is a matter of huge consequence. Millions of dollars of exports hang in the balance. And all of this rests on a crucial question. Can we tell the difference between an invasive species and a regular old non-native species? Do we think we know enough to spot an invasion before it's too late? Let's clear this up right at the start. There is a big disagreement over whether American lobsters are, in fact, invading Europe. To date, in all of Europe, there have been around 100 American lobsters discovered. Hardly an army. Everyone agrees that all of them were clearly escaped from tanks somewhere and weren't born in the wild. Some even still had rubber bands around their claws when they were found. Only 3 of them have been found that have hybrid eggs. But for sure, scientists see the potential for a total catastrophe. And so they've been doing science to try to figure out what's the risk. Anne Lisbeth hatched those hybrid eggs that came in the door, 10,500 lobster larvae. And of all of those thousands, 65 are still alive and creeping their way towards maturity. So far, Anne Lisbeth has been testing the males. She's checking their sperm counts using a technique called electroejaculation, trying to see if they have what it takes to reproduce in the wild using electrodes.
So we put the red on one side and black on the other side of where the opening is, where the spermatophore is.
Wow.
Bzz. Not too much bzz, just a little bit of pleasant bzz. A little tickle.
Yeah, a tickle.
And this is a method developed by American scientists.
I don't doubt it. So far, her results are inconclusive. They aren't producing much sperm. It might be that even 7 years after being born, they still aren't quite mature yet. Or it could be that they're actually sterile. No matter what she discovers, Anne Lisbeth thinks there's reason to be worried. The Scandinavians have already decimated their own lobster stocks through overfishing. So whether there's actually a breeding population of American and hybrid lobsters out there pushing around the diminished European population, muscling them out of the best protective rocky crevices, or if they're just sterile and wandering around out there as false targets for the Europeans' breeding efforts. Either way, it's bad for the native lobsters. Suzanne Eriksson is a Swedish scientist at the University of Gothenburg. She also has a clutch of hybrid lobsters that she has been rearing in a quarantine tank.
So worst case scenario is that we lose lobster production completely. That's the absolute worst case scenario.
Since that first clutch of hybrids came in, there's been nearly a decade of research. And then, starting in 2014, American lobsters started to show up in traps more consistently, and the Scandinavians got really serious about this threat. It was the Swedes that got the ball rolling. They wrote a report that concluded that the American lobster was a high-risk species, and that imports should be banned. The Americans were less than thrilled.
So when you first heard about this idea that Sweden wanted to ban live lobster imports, what was the response from the industry?
You've got to be kidding me. That was the initial reaction, and then it was, how do we deal with this?
Annie Slikas, president of the Maine Lobster Dealers Association. She says, before we ring the alarm bells over a couple of pregnant lobster, we have to ask, how exactly are they crossing the ocean? She says no, they did not walk or swim over. Likely they came by airplane. Europeans really love lobster and they are willing to pay a premium to get it. And they're coming out of facilities like this one. It's a totally unremarkable building in an industrial park in York, Maine. There were these 2 medium-sized swimming pools packed with submerged crates.
So if you are on a plane from Boston Logan to Paris, France, or to Dubai, or to Shanghai, there's a very, very good chance that there are lobsters riding with you in the cargo hold.
So not snakes on a plane.
Not snakes on a plane, lobsters on a plane.
This is particularly true if you're headed to Dubai. Annie says Emirates actually increased the number of flights between Boston and the UAE to accommodate the lobster shipments. And yes, apparently, as long as their gills are kept moist, they can survive for days or even weeks out of the water. And this whole process is tight. The lobsters leave this facility in boxes, on pallets, wrapped in shrink wrap, and wrapped in a special TSA tape to ensure that they haven't been tampered with. They cannot get out on their own. Clearly, the lobsters are escaping once they get to Europe. How? It might be that after buying them, some people are putting them into illegal floating cages out in the ocean to keep them fresh. and they escape from those. There have also been a couple of high-profile instances of Buddhists or animal rights activists buying hundreds of American lobsters and releasing them as an act of compassion, only to get fined afterward. But if you ask Aunt Lisbeth, anyone who's letting these lobsters out shares one trait.
Stupid people. Whether they release them on purpose or they release them by chance, they think they are dead and then they are not. Or if they keep them in some kind of containers in the ocean and then there is a hole in this container and then they escape. I mean, there are a whole bunch of scenarios.
So, because of stupid people, Annie Slikas and the American lobster industry were looking at, overnight, losing $150 million of exports a year. 20% of live lobster exports go to Europe. And so the Americans are basically like, hey, Europe, the problem is clearly on your end, so just get your house in order. But also, more to the point, they said, even if there are Buddhists tossing hundreds of them into the ocean, we just can't believe that this invasion could ever actually happen.
When you think about invasive species, they're typically ones that reproduce really quickly and efficiently, and lobsters are the antithesis of that.
In response to the Swedes' risk assessment, they called out the cavalry. One of the scientists who they asked to give feedback was Bob Stenick. He's a lobster researcher at the University of Maine.
And I am hawkish about the language we use. This non-native species has been found in those waters. This has not been demonstrated to meet even the minimum criteria of being invasive.
Let's just reflect for a moment on two words, non-native and invasive. I think a lot of people probably have a negative association with both words, but I'd also be willing to go a step further. I think a lot of people actually conflate the two words, and that's a mistake. For instance, tomatoes, non-native, but also definitely not invasive. On the other hand, ivy or wisteria or bittersweet or any number of other common garden plants, invasive.
As a matter of fact, the vast majority of non-native introductions do not succeed.
In other words, for every invasive bug or fish, there are tons of animals that just can't hack it in the new environment. Just as an example, maybe you've heard about the scourge of the invasive zebra mussel, which came over from Europe in the ballast water of ships. The total cost of the zebra mussel invasion is estimated to be $3.1 billion over 10 years. Hearing that might lead you to believe that ballast water is just teeming with foreign invaders trying to explode into our waters. But
about two decades ago, a guy named Jim Carlton down in Connecticut, Mystic Seaport, he's an expert on this. He went and looked at ballast water in ships. In one of his studies, he identified 10,000 species in the ballast water. Now, one or two possibly could be invasive.
The point here is not that invasive species are no big deal, because they are.
It's a significant problem.
It's just that we have a really hard time knowing what's going to be an invasive species before the invasion actually begins. And assuming that every non-native bug or plant or crustacean is going to be a plague with massive impacts on ecosystems just isn't correct. So, we know that American lobsters are escaping in Europe. What's the evidence that they're not only going to survive, but reproduce, and that the larva will thrive and that the American lobster will start to take over? Back in the early 1900s, Bob Stenick says people saw the prospects of an American lobster invasion very differently. The thinking back then was
that this is an amazing species, and we should strive to propagate it all over the world.
And entrepreneurial Americans set about trying to make this happen.
Many operations sprouted up.
They started actively introducing hundreds of lobsters all over the world, like British Columbia,
Bodega Bay, California,
France, Italy. Hundreds were also released accidentally in Ireland,
Japan, and other places.
And every time, American lobsters failed to get themselves established.
And it was really kind of surprising that a species that is so abundant in the western North Atlantic, that's on our coast, seemed incapable of self-reproduction outside of its native range.
Mm-hmm. So for years, we've had all sorts of people try to get lobsters to invade other waters, and it has never worked. 100 American lobsters caught in Europe over the last 10 years. Bob Stenick says this is not an invasion. And it's expert testimony like this that the fishing industry gathered to make their case. Maine's whole congressional delegation signed a letter saying that there's no way that the lobster is invasive. The State Department got involved. Canadian fishing regulators wrote in supporting the American position. But the Swedes, they aren't buying it.
Last year, unfortunately, a hybrid clutch was caught in Sweden. So they are clearly reproducing in our waters.
That's Suzanne Erickson again. Her point is that just because lobsters haven't thrived and taken over in other places at other times doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. Sure, in the past, Americans haven't gotten a foothold, but things are different now. Now, Europe's population has crashed in some places, leaving a hole in their ecological niche that something else could fill. Now, global trade might mean that there are hundreds, even thousands, being released each year, but we just don't know.
And remember that every female, she carries tens of thousands of eggs.
And also, she says, just because a few dozen have been caught in each country, that means nothing. Let's remember, at first, finding an American lobster in Europe was super rare.
But since 2014, they're caught annually, every year. So although they're not that many adults, they are reproducing both with American offspring and with hybrid offspring.
What do you want to wait for here? Do we wait until they're finding live juveniles out in the wild, a clear sign that Europeans are reproducing and succeeding in Europe? Do we wait until there are adult, hybrid, European-American lobsters coming into the traps? Suzanne argues that at that point, it would be too late. An invasive population would already be getting itself underway. This debate is not really about lobsters, in my personal opinion. It's about uncertainty and what we should do in the face of it. There's this idea that environmentalists like to cite, something called the precautionary principle. It says that when there's something that we can do and we don't really know what the impact could be, the safest course of action is to do nothing. In Europe, this is a much more popular idea than here in the US, and it was the guiding philosophy that led the EU to ban genetically modified crops in the late 90s. And when you read the EU's American lobster risk assessment, it specifically says that it relies on the precautionary principle to come to its conclusion that imports should be banned. American regulators, on the other hand, don't really go for this idea. We tend to prefer straight-ahead cost-benefit analysis, knowing what we know, do the downsides outweigh the upsides? The European philosophy gives a lot more deference to the incompleteness of human knowledge. It assumes that our cost-benefit analysis is going to be flawed, imperfect, that it could be missing some big downsides. But a lot of Americans, like Bob Stenick, will tell you that the way the Europeans implement the precautionary principle leads to a kind of status quo bias. Like, new things are seen as risky, but decisions that might be equally risky but were made a while ago are seen as okay. Like, say, letting ships release 10,000 non-native species every time they flush their ballast water.
And you want to say, well, maybe we should just stop shipping lobsters to Europe. Then I think that level of caution should actually also apply to shipping. So you should actually stop ships from coming out from outside Europe if you really want to have zero chance of anything non-native from arriving. I don't think they're going to do that.
Right.
But I'm just saying, you know, if you want to raise the precautionary principle, then I think you should be fair about what the risks are for every ship that's coming into your waters.
Right. There's like the precautionary principle, if followed to its logical conclusion,
right,
would lead us to just building walls around the borders of all the continents.
That's right. And Scandinavia's going to pay for it.
In the end, delegations from all the EU countries met behind closed doors and hashed it out. And behind those closed doors, they took a vote. Annie Slikas heard about the outcome after it happened.
I actually was in the process of doing a story with a reporter from the Financial Times, and the reporter was the one that called me and said, you guys are, you're good. Which just sort of felt anticlimactic.
Like there should be, it should have been a vote, like, right, like on live TV.
Yeah, exactly. There should have been something like, where's my C-SPAN?
Thanks, in part, to a massive show of force from the Americans and Canadians that included scientific rebuttals from Bob Stenick and others, the ban was voted down. According to the Swedish delegate, the Europeans agreed that the American lobster was likely invasive, but given the economic impact a ban would have, they decided to vote no for the time being. The precautionary principle might feel like a coherent philosophy, but when there's real money at stake, it becomes clear that it's not immune to politics and economics.
If you are at a seafood restaurant in Paris or in Brussels or in Spain, and you get a seafood tower, which is a very common thing to have, it always has lobster from North America on that tower.
All of this has sent the Scandinavians back to the drawing board. Suzanne Eriksson, the Swedish scientist, says that the next project she's going to try to get funding for is to see if she can detect live American or hybrid lobster larvae out in the ocean. This would be super hard, because after they hatch, lobster are tiny little plankton-sized critters for a couple of years, and while there might be tens of thousands when they first come out, they are tasty, bite-sized ocean snacks, and very, very few of them survive for very long. But if she did find larvae, that's when the alarm bells would really start to go off in her mind.
Yeah, that's when you know that it's established, you know, because we already know that they survive and we know that they reproduce. But once you have recruitment and they start to add up in numbers, then you have establishment, which means that it's invasive. And it doesn't, you know, you have to remember that these are very long-lived animals. So when you look at a species that reproduces very quickly, because that has been one argument that, you know, they have to like explode in numbers. But that takes quite a long time for long-lived animals. So I hope that it can be fixed. That's what I really hope. But I'm not sure about that.
When I asked Bob Stenick about Suzanne's plan, he said, good luck.
It's a needle in a haystack. And they have a much, much bigger haystack over there.
He says in his mind, finding larvae in the open ocean would move the needle, but still wouldn't be conclusive proof that lobsters could invade. He'd want proof that those larvae could survive to be adults and then reproduce again.
To make the case that that the lobster is invasive requires that they are reproducing, and not seeing reproduction, it doesn't necessarily mean it's not happening.
Right, but it
just hasn't been detected.
Yeah, especially in the vastness of the ocean, it's like hard to tell what the hell's going on down there.
No, that's right. And, you know, there are still people who believe in Sasquatch, too. So you do have to be realistic and say, well, we've looked enough to say that this is probably not an issue. I certainly have never been in favor of stopping the investigation.
But when you're comparing people to Sasquatch hunters, you're clearly being pretty dismissive of their argument. And this is what's crazy about this debate. Let's just think about what it would take to get either side to change their mind. Bob's definition of the point where you start to get concerned, larvae surviving into adulthood and reproducing, is the Scandinavians' definition of an invasion already in progress. So if the Swedes succeed in getting live lobster imports banned next time around, they'll think that they've stopped a disaster, but the Bob Stenicks of the world will always think it was overkill. Basically, the only way to settle this debate for sure would be to do nothing and see what happens. So what makes a species succeed where another doesn't? Can we come up with a grand, unified theory of species propagation? We'll take a stab at it after a short break. Welcome back. This is Outside In from New Hampshire Public Radio. Today, we're talking about which species thrive and which don't.
Do you hear any birds?
No.
recently, I went on two expeditions looking for birds. The first was with a friend of mine, Stu, on the side of New Hampshire's biggest, most famous rock pile, Mount Washington.
It's almost like snipe hunting. We're going snipe hunting.
We're looking for Littlefoot, cousin of Bigfoot.
Spot number two, a much smaller hill, with two friends of the show, Dave Anderson and Chris Martin, host of NHPR's long-running Nature Facts podcast, Something Wild.
These birds live in a stone fortress of granite.
Yeah, or big hollow logs. That's another place they might nest.
Abandoned buildings.
Yeah, old abandoned buildings in the woods.
And rocky den sites like this.
In the first case, on Mount Washington, with Stu.
This is great.
We're looking for the Bicknell's thrush.
Love the sound of birds in the morning.
Yeah.
A small, unremarkable songbird, brown on top, gray with little spots on the belly. In the summer, it's only found in high-elevation forests in the northeastern U.S. and southeastern Canada, and there's only about 100,000 of them total. In the second expedition, on the little rocky hill with Dave and Chris, we're looking for one of the Western Hemisphere's most ubiquitous birds, the turkey vulture.
If they feel trapped, they will regurgitate on you.
Cool.
They hiss. They have a naked
wait,
head.
Wait, do they hiss first?
We'll find out.
Okay.
That's why I brought my sunglasses.
Supposedly, Dave knows where one of these majestic scavengers is nesting. Up on Mount Washington with Stu, as you heard...
No.
We struck out. But down lower, with Chris and Dave looking for the turkey vulture...
There he is. Whoa. So right now, my adrenaline is redlined. That just scared the crap out of me.
After scrambling up the rocky slope... We spooked a fully grown turkey vulture, 6 feet of silent black wings, a wrinkly, bald, pink head out of its nest. She or he spent the next 15 minutes flying in high, lazy circles above us.
The other one is probably out gathering food right now. I wouldn't expect it to be in here, guarding the young if there are young, which there should be.
Would they be eggs or chicks?
There could be eggs, but at this time of year, June, they're probably chicks. But it's hard to say until somebody takes a look.
And typically, so. One or two.
Can we go closer?
Yeah. Oh, we're going in.
I'm going closer.
I'll follow.
The nest is not really a nest. It's just a crevice in a field of boulders. And actually, what Chris and Dave did was send in the guy with the microphone first. The entrance was too small to stand or to crouch, so I had to sort of slither in on my belly.
Oh my gosh.
By the way, we cleared this with Chris, who is a biologist with the Audubon Society.
So Chris, how close can I get before I'm being problematic?
And right there, just a few feet from the entrance, two fluffy little turkey vulture chicks.
Oh my gosh, they're tiny!
So, two bird-chasing excursions. One for the rare and difficult-to-spot Bicknell's thrush, which ended in failure. The second, poking around in craggy corners for turkey vultures, a success. These two birds, the turkey vultures that we found and the Bicknell's thrush that we didn't, they're representative of a trend that's underway right under your nose.
I think turkey vultures are just about a perfect creature. They are a bird that can be seen by almost everyone in the hemisphere.
The Bicknells pigeonhole themselves into a pretty narrow ecological niche. And if these habitats disappear from our mountaintops, I don't think the birds are going to just find a different place to go.
This is the tale of two birds. One, the turkey vulture, is almost universally reviled, but they're also pretty amazing in their way. The other, the Bicknell's thrush, is a local celebrity, the target of research dollars and enthusiastic birdwatchers, but it's in a tight spot, literally and figuratively. And the story of these two birds actually tells us a story about our world as a whole. It tells us where we're headed, towards a world of songbirds and high alpine gardens, or toward one where vultures inherit the earth. Right here at the top, I want to introduce you to an idea. You know how natural selection works. Random mutations make individuals that are slightly different, slightly more able to succeed, all that. Now, one thing this does is the longer a species hangs out in a specific place, the better and better it gets at living in that place. They become really incredibly good at finding food and surviving, much better than species that range more widely and live in many different places. This is called specialization. And as long as habitats are not changing very much, it's the logical conclusion of natural selection. So now that you know that natural selection drives towards specialization, let's take a look at the Bicknell's thrush, starting with the guy who discovered it.
On June 15th, 1881, believe it or not, I know the exact date.
That's wildlife biologist Chris Rimmer. He's basically the world's expert on these birds.
An amateur ornithologist named Eugene P. Bicknell was hiking around on Slide Mountain in the Catskills of New York.
Hiking around and sees a bird that he doesn't recognize. It's a thrush that he doesn't recognize. And that was unusual for him.
So as ornithologists did in those days, he pulled out his shotgun.
And he collected the bird. Just in case you didn't know this, Audubon, like James Audubon that the Bird Society was named for, also shot a ton of birds. Bicknell shot two of them and picked them up.
Examined them in his hand, still didn't recognize them, and thereupon sent them down to the Smithsonian, where they were identified as a new subspecies or race of the gray-cheeked thrush, which is a much more northern and widely distributed bird.
Case closed, right? Well, fast forward 100 years. In the 1990s, along comes this Canadian
biologist, a taxonomist, a zoogeographer named Henri Ouellette. He worked for the National Museum of Canada in Ottawa.
Something about the Bicknell's gray-cheeked thrush thing didn't quite sit right with him, so he gets to work.
So he examined specimens in museums.
Finds very slight differences in the feathers and body sizes. He then listens to them singing.
The songs of the two species, which are slightly different.
And if you play the song of the one species so that the other could hear it, they just didn't react, which is weird.
Because if you play the song of a, let's say, a song sparrow or a robin to another robin, usually they're going to react because they think there's an intruder on their territory. They got to drive it out, right?
And then comes the most important bit of evidence.
The final nail in the coffin.
He tested their DNA and found that they were different enough that probably the two species stopped breeding together around 1 million years ago. So he writes all this up in a paper, brings it to the authorities.
To the sort of God squad of ornithological taxonomy, the American Ornithologists Union Checklist Committee, and they accepted it. And so in 1995, the switch was made. Bicknell's went from being a subspecies of gray cheek to being its own distinct species.
Let me just be clear about what this is. This is a small population of birds that 1 million years ago started living further south than its former compatriots. Because they've now become separated, the two populations stop breeding with each other. But this happened relatively recently in evolutionary terms, so there haven't been enough random mutations to make them actually look different.
You can't tell them apart. People say they can, I don't believe it.
But science tells us they're different enough to be a new species, though a new species that is almost indistinguishable from the old one. And there is nothing that birders love more than a new species.
So we're doing 20-minute surveys at each point.
This means people care enough about them to design a study to keep track of them, called Mountain Bird Watch.
And I can still hear that winter wren. He's really far away.
And that's why we're on the side of Mount Washington at the beginning of the story. Every year, a bunch of volunteers and a few college students paid by Chris Rimmer's organization, the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, go up and very carefully, very scientifically, count birds. That first one you heard was Nate Lawner, and here's another. Kirsty Carr.
What I think is so cool is that it's endemic to the Northeast, and
it's like, it's our bird.
It's our bird. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's globally rare, and it travels all the way down to the Caribbean area, you know, to like the island of Hispaniola, I guess, is this place where it overwinters the most.
So you see, in the summer, when they're breeding, Bicknell's thrush only lives in high-altitude forests in the northeast of the U.S. and the southeast of Canada. And then in the winter, they fly south, and some crazy number, maybe as much as 90% of them, spend the winter on Hispaniola, mostly in the Dominican Republic. Just think how crazy that is. There are lots of big islands down there. Cuba, Puerto Rico, Jamaica. But the thrushes are picky, and the vast majority of them go to this one 30,000 square mile island. This bird is a specialist. It can survive in just one kind of habitat. There are lots of specialists out there. Koalas, for example, can only eat eucalyptus leaves. Piping plovers can only nest on sparsely vegetated beaches. The monarch butterfly caterpillar can only feed on milkweed leaves. The Bicknell's thrush is like those more famous specialists. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology says it has one of the most restricted breeding and wintering ranges of any North American bird. If anything goes wrong in the places it lives, it's got nowhere else to go. Now, in contrast, allow me to reintroduce you to...
Turkey vultures are just amazing in that they can eat disease and neutralize it.
The turkey vulture.
Turkey vultures can eat things like an animal that has died from anthrax. They can also eat an animal that's died of botulism toxin or cholera. The turkey vulture can eat it, and it doesn't affect the turkey vulture in any negative way.
Our turkey vulture enthusiast, by the by, is Katie Fallon, who wrote Vulture, The Private Life of an Unloved Bird.
I actually had a few other possible subtitles for the book. One was Vulture, Eat Your Heart Out, and another one was Vulture, Happy Entrails to You.
The crux of Katie's book is that turkey vultures deserve some cred here for cleaning up after us.
We... unfortunately, aren't as fond of these birds as I think we should be because of the great service they provide.
Most of what makes turkey vultures so amazing is how incredibly well adapted to eating dead things they are. But since that's gross, I'm going to intersperse gross but cool turkey vulture facts with some straight up cool turkey vulture facts here. So, turkey vulture stomach acid is roughly 10 times more acidic than human stomach acid, which means by the time it gets to the other end, their waste is both clean and very acidic. So as a strategy, they deposit it all over their legs.
That helps cool them off if it's hot, but we also think that that liquid waste acts as a sanitizer and kills bacteria that might be on their feet from standing on a carcass. So it's sort of like they carry their hand sanitizer with them.
Right. Gross, but cool. Straight up cool. You know how you see them soaring all the time, lazily tipping their wings back and forth in the hot air?
Yeah, they can soar for a long period of time. They've done some studies where they've put implants in turkey vultures to monitor their heart rate and their respiration rates. And they found that when a turkey vulture is soaring, its heart rate is about the same as when it's asleep.
That's
pretty
amazing. Yeah, my heart rate goes up if I'm sitting in a chair versus lying in a bed. Okay. Just a couple more. Gross cool, turkey vulture heads are bald so they won't get rotting meat chunks stuck to feathers when they're jamming them into carcasses. Regular old cool, even though most birds can't really smell at all, turkey vultures' noses are so good that in one case study, a bunch of farmers were shooting and burying groundhogs only to find them dug up and eaten the next day.
They have documented them being able to smell something like a dead rat underneath leaves in a forest. And they've also documented turkey vultures actually digging up carcasses that have been intentionally buried.
And all of these various evolutionary talents add up to an extremely successful bird.
They breed from South Central Canada throughout the most of North America, Central America, and all of South America. They're even on islands, Caribbean islands, the Falkland Islands has turkey vultures. They're a bird that can be seen by almost everyone in the hemisphere. I think turkey vultures are just about a perfect creature.
So they're like an amazing generalist.
Yes, they are. They are an amazing generalist, exactly.
A generalist. They're thriving everywhere. They can nest in a rocky talus slope or in an abandoned warehouse. They don't need a very specific set of ecological conditions in order to survive. They take what they've got and they work with it. There are lots of these. Cockroaches, rats, ravens, raccoons, and jellyfish. Quite often, generalists do a good job living alongside humans. I mean, if you think about it, we're really the most obvious example of a generalist. So we've got one very rare bird that needs a very specific habitat to survive, and another that can live almost everywhere. Which of them is winning and why, after a short break. Before the break, we told you about two species, the Bicknell's thrush that can only live in a very tiny set of places and the turkey vulture that lives everywhere. Now, you've probably heard this part of the story already. Species are disappearing. Many scientists believe we're in the midst of something that will eventually be recognized as a mass extinction event. And those extinctions? They're coming for the specialists first.
Yeah, so I'm Romain Julliard. I'm working at the National Museum for Natural History in Paris.
This is Romain Julliard, who came up with a way to mathematically define what a specialist species is.
Since the beginning of our survey, which is now 25 years old, that's on average specialist species population size have decreased by 20%.
But this is the story you've heard already. The other half of the story is that specialists are being replaced by generalists.
And it's almost balanced by the increase in population size of generalist species.
Almost balanced. So while specialists are declining, generalist species are growing. Now, Romain studies birds, and we have been talking about birds, but this is not just a bird thing.
There's really a striking common pattern that specialist species are declining in everywhere.
So, all around the world.
And that was true in coral, fish, marsupials in Australia.
The Bicknell's thrushes and species like them.
And bumblebees in the UK.
Are struggling.
Yeah, and some plants also.
And the turkey vultures, the generalists, are doing better. They're actually getting more numerous. Just one particularly terrifying example. A few years ago, the first study ever to try to estimate global jellyfish populations came out, and it found that in 60% of the world's oceans, jellies are on the rise. The headlines that followed, jellyfish are taking over the oceans. We're headed toward a jellyfish world. What's the deal? Well, it's really not a surprise.
Well, it's most likely habitat degradation. I mean, it's the most parsimonious explanation.
The most parsimonious explanation. If you only know how to live in one place, and that place is changing because of logging or invasive plants or increased forest fires or not enough forest fires or whatever the problem is locally, you're in a tough spot. And that's the story with our bird, too.
No matter how much is done in North America, if in the wintering range there are no changes, it's a bottleneck.
This is Yolanda León, executive director of Grupo Jaragua, a conservation organization down in the Dominican Republic. While we snooty New Englanders think of the Bicknell's thrush as our bird, it spends half the year in the Caribbean too. Nearly all of the population spends the winter on a single island, and a lot of them are in a single place.
Right now, most of the habitat for many of these mountain birds and other species is in Sierra de Bauruco.
The Sierra del Bauruco is a mountain range on the border with Haiti. It's also a national park, the biggest in the Dominican Republic.
And you would think, because it's a national park, it's protected and the birds are safe there. However, what we found out was that there was a lot of agriculture going on inside the park. This is all illegal agriculture.
This is what's called a paper park. The government declared it off limits, but its borders aren't marked or enforced. So over time, people have started to cut down trees and grow crops. In particular, wealthy farmers have started to grow avocados.
And these are export avocados.
So this is like Chipotle, you know, all the guacamole that we love.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I love avocados. Some people say it's like, you're opposed to avocado. I love avocado, but avocados don't have to be produced in a national park.
A quick aside, apparently most of the Dominican Republic's avocados go to Europe, not to Chipotle. And let me just put a big old disclaimer here. National parks in developing economies is a complicated, fraught topic. Some subsistence farmers actually were in this park and had it declared right on top of them. And others are folks who genuinely didn't know the park was here because, you know, it's just on paper.
Like with the avocado and the farming, there are big players and small players. And I think chasing after the small players, the poorest people, is not the best solution, and it's not very fair.
But after all caveats about the problems with how Western-style conservation is executed in the developing world, it's pretty easy to recognize that this isn't a good situation for our bird.
On the north side of Bauruco, we do have a good area that seems to be off limits because of road access, and I think that area, it's pretty safe. But on the south side of Bauruco, if nothing is done in the next 2 to 5 years, we are not going to have any more of the birds or any of its fauna.
Habitat degradation, a specialist's worst nightmare. And it's happening up on the north end of their range, too.
Yes, absolutely. It's one of the most vulnerable habitat types in the Northeast.
Here's Chris Rimmer again. Remember, in the summer, Bicknell's thrush live in a specific type of forest up on the sides and tops of mountains.
These forests are predicted to begin getting pushed upslope by warming temperatures. And if these habitats disappear from our mountaintops, I don't think the birds are going to just find a different place to go. They've pigeonholed themselves into a pretty narrow ecological niche.
Meanwhile, turkey vultures, they're thriving.
25 years ago, we thought there were about 5 million turkey vultures.
Since then, we've made more roads, which mean more roadkill and also more hot air updrafts to surf along. There's also less shooting and poisoning of vultures going on, and warmer winters probably are better for them too. Less frozen meat. So today,
and the most recent estimates that I've read are, you know, we might have as many as 20 million turkey vultures worldwide.
This is the trajectory we're on. The beautiful, finely tuned specialists, hyper-efficient little motors built to extract calories from their own very, very specific habitats, are on their way out. And as they vanish, the perhaps equally beautiful in their own way, generalists are rising to fill the space that's left behind. You can already see the same starlings and house sparrows and pigeons in almost any city anywhere in the world. In my mind, there's this nightmare scenario where the skies are full of nothing but turkey vultures. The forests and the cities are full of skunks and raccoons, and the oceans are populated entirely by jellyfish. It's the stuff of dystopian novels. It's the jellyfish world.
So I don't think we'll... I mean, we really need to work hard to have the nightmare scenario.
Ah, a reminder from Romain Julliard. Remember where specialization comes from? in stable environments, specialists actually do better than generalists.
You need really a very high pressure to maintain this homogenization.
Specialists are just better than generalists at getting food in their very special niche.
If you relax a bit, evolution is really a force that drives to specialization and differentiation.
So, if we stop doing all the things that we're doing that make life hard on them, and the habitats stabilize, the specialists will start to thrive again. And given enough time, we'll even get new specialist species. The problem today is environments are changing faster than evolution can change the animals. Really, if you set your frame of reference long enough, thousands of years, even millions of years, there's very little that the Earth can't recover from.
So I think we should still be optimistic and.
So are you optimistic then?
There's no objective reason to be optimistic because the pattern is still the decrease wherever you look at, but it's still reversible. That's the point.
That was a very scientific answer.
Yeah.
Objective reason to be optimistic. But maybe we should try anyway. Pretty much my motto going through life. We've got just a little bit of time left today, so we're going to use it to answer one of your questions. We have a hotline. The number is 1-844-GO-OTTER, where we take your questions and bring you the answers.
Why do geese make V's? Does a bumblebee sneeze? Can a person eat trees? Can a polar bear freeze? Is a kidney stone kind of like a pearl in a clam?
Well, I don't know. Ask Sam.
So I'm here with producer Hannah McCarthy.
Hello.
And producer Jim Gutierrez.
Hey.
All right. Well, let's hear the first question.
Hi, this is Claire Dunning, and I'm calling from St. George, Maine, in the middle of a thunderstorm. And I'm wondering whether harbor seals and other aquatic life know if it's raining or not.
Like, the obvious question is, like, when they're below water or above water? I don't think they know when they're below water.
Well, she does say, and other aquatic life. I think she might mean below water.
Yeah.
I feel like, and I'm generalizing because I have no idea what the answer is to this. If you live outside, would you not be more perceptive to what happens outside, i.e. a thunderstorm?
Yeah, they've got to know.
They got to know.
Yeah.
But, like, there must be a certain point at which you get far enough down where it's just, like, nothing's affecting you.
So how far down is that?
I think this is what we got to nail down. We've got to nail down, like, the number. Like, how many feet down can you tell that there's weather up above you? Oh, hello?
Hello.
Hey, this is Sam Evans-Brown from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Hi, Sam. This is Jim Harvey. I'm the director at Moss Landing Marine Laboratories and have been a marine mammal expert for the last 40 years or so.
So thoughts? Does a harbor seal, when they're underwater, do they have any way of knowing if they're in bad weather? And then when they're above water, do they know / care when they're in bad weather?
Interesting that you asked this. Just the other day, we had a speaker here at Moss Landing Marine Labs talking about they have a hydrophone in Monterey Bay that's listening to whatever's making noise in the ocean, and they could actually hear rain on the surface of the ocean down at almost 1,000 feet underwater.
What?
Yes.
Whoa.
That's amazing.
So the answer is that if the harbor seals are listening, have as good a listening as the hydrophone that they have here in the bay, that yes, certainly seals should be able to hear rain. If they were underwater, they should be able to hear rain if they can hear that frequency. I don't know if they can hear that exact frequency, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And then as far as the surface, like being at the surface, if it was lightly raining, the harbor seals would lay around on the land and on shore and rest. But if it rained very, very hard, then you could watch the seals jump into the water and get out of it.
It's sort of like, well, if I'm going to be 100% soaked anyway, I might as well not be being hit by the water.
Exactly. Well, I'd be pelted by rain if you can just be in the water. And of course, they're really well adapted to being in the ocean. So to them, it's no big deal to jump in the water and stay there for a long period of time and not be cold.
Cool. Thanks so much for your time.
No problem.
That was great. That was a way more satisfying an answer than I expected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Outside In was produced this week by me, Sam Evans-Brown, with help from Hannah McCarthy, Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Justine Paradise. Erica Janik is our executive producer, and Maureen McMurray is our director of creative flow states. Special thanks this week to Sophia Brockmark, Patrick Whittle, and Wynn Watson. Music in this week's episode came to us from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, David Sestay, Jason Leonard, Ikimashu Aoi, and the Marion Circle Drum Brigade. If you can't get enough Outside In, subscribe to our podcast. There are new episodes every 2 weeks. It's available in all of the places: Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, literally wherever you get podcasts. Our theme music is from Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.